So, it's April 15th, and I am still kind of waiting for spring, not altogether patiently. There's stuff coming up in my gardens, and I want to get out and touch it, gently remove the remains of the late fallen oak leaves from last year from around the tender shoots, see where there might be empty places that will absolutely require me to go spend a lot of money at local garden centers. I want to mow the lawn and take in that fresh-cut grass weed smell. I want to reseed the bare patches, put out the deck furniture, take off my jacket and turn my pasty face to the sun. I want to watch the Red Sox play at Fenway not in hats and gloves and long sleeves and neck warmers and heavy jackets, but in sunglasses and short sleeves. It's been a typical, moving on to a typical longish New England winter, and we're ready for the big, glorious miracle that is spring. I feel my impatience. I want Mother Nature to flip the switch on this winter to off. This is a season, generally, this time of the vernal equinox and daylight savings time and Passover and Easter, when there are lots of big things that we may celebrate, stories that may be foundational to our faith, natural phenomena that lift our spirits and give us feelings of hope, the return of the late afternoon light, the liberation of the Hebrew people from bondage in Egypt, Jesus arising up from the grave. These big events are important to us. As a kid, I went to Sunday school in the local Presbyterian church my family attended at the time, and we learned a lot of stories from the Bible, which is one of the texts, foundational texts of our Unitarian Universalism. Two of the stories that caught my young imagination both came from the book of Daniel. In the first story, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, who just might be an ancestor of a certain person who's in the news a lot, Nebuchadnezzar made a 90-foot gold statue of himself and decreed that whenever anyone heard the sound of a horn, pipe, zither, triangle, dulcimer, or full consort of music, they were to prostrate themselves and worship the gold image or be thrown forthwith into a blazing furnace. Now, some of the king's counselors, who were already jealous of some of the Jewish advisors who had been promoted over them in the management of the province, took this opportunity to spy on and report three of these men, named Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, for refusing to worship the gold image. King Nebuchadnezzar gave them a direct opportunity to comply with the decree after they were turned in, but they refused to turn from their faith. So Nebuchadnezzar ordered that the furnace be heated to 7 times its usual heat, and the men were bound, fully dressed, and thrown into the furnace. Now, apparently, the king had a way of seeing down into the flames because he got very upset and asked his advisors, "Didn't I order 3 men thrown into the pit? Because I see 4 of them walking around down there, and one of them looks like a god." He went down to the furnace and opened the door and called, "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out!" And when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego emerged from the fire, the king and all of his courtiers gathered around them and saw how the fire had had no power to burn their bodies. The hair of their heads had not been singed, their trousers were untouched, and no smell of fire lingered about them. Wow, huh? Thanks to an angel of the Lord, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego walked out of the fire. Later, in that same book of Daniel, Daniel himself likewise refused to worship another king of Babylon and got thrown into a den of lions and emerged unscathed. And again, my young self went, wow. A few weeks ago, my book group got together for its monthly meeting, and one member complimented another on her haircut. "Thanks," she beamed. "It's the second haircut I've had." In her struggle with cancer, the chemotherapy treatments had, as they so often do, caused her to lose all of her hair. And now it's growing back, enough to need to be cut twice. And my middle-aged self said, wow. I left my job in Boston almost a year ago now. So instead of the alarm going off at 4:30 in the morning so I can be out of the house at 5:30 to beat the worst of the traffic into the city, I'm usually sitting on the sofa in my sunroom with a cup of coffee around 7, watching chickadees and nuthatches, tufted titmice, and goldfinches pop in and out time and again from the nowhere near blooming forsythia bushes to nibble at the feeder. And these days, some of what they drop on the ground is falling onto little shoots of greenness that might eventually turn into a hyacinth or a daffodil or an iris or a lily. Yay. These little things, maybe they're not so little. These daily occurrences in our lives that bring a smile to our eyes, to our hearts, maybe even to our lips. I'm just thinking that maybe these are important, maybe just as important as the big myths, the big stories and experiences of our lives. And I don't mean to in any way imply for even a moment that those aren't huge. The coming out to friends and family about who we really are that has heretofore been hidden away. The transitions in jobs, the births of children, in the big life choices. But maybe it's the case that we don't have to wait for Easter to celebrate resurrection. Maybe we don't have to wait for March 21st or Memorial Day to celebrate the end of winter. Maybe we are always emerging. Maybe everything and everyone around us is always changing, always transitioning from one way of being to another. And maybe that's worthy of our noticing, supporting, and celebrating. And maybe that practice helps us to move from our current way of being to being something a little bit more aligned with who and how we want to be. Irish poet David White has this to say. Surely, even you at times have felt the grand array, the swelling presence, and the chorus crowding out your solo voice. You must note the way the soap dish enables you, or the window latch grants you freedom. Alertness is the hidden discipline of familiarity. The stairs are your mentor of things to come. The doors have always been there to frighten you and invite you. And the tiny speaker in the phone is your dream ladder to divinity. Put down the weight of your aloneness and ease into the conversation. The kettle is singing even as it pours you a drink. The cooking pots have left their arrogant aloofness and seen the good in you at last. All the birds and creatures of the world are unutterably themselves. Everything is waiting for you. You know, these are difficult times. We know they are. We talk about it a lot, don't we? How utterly frustrating, infuriating, overwhelming, and crazy-making our country is, and all of these issues, the leaning into violence and greed that gets expressed in some new way, some new outrage every day, it seems. This political and cultural stuff is all on top of what's already a challenging life with family and friends and jobs and obligations and bodies and pets and homes, all needing stuff from us. Maybe we really need, for the sake of our sanity, of our souls, to take time to think of all of the things that are totally worthy of praise, honor, celebration, and awe that we can sometimes, in our busyness or our habits, overlook. Maybe that's how, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we emerge from the fiery furnace without being singed. I like reading articles about brain science as long as they're not very technical, because I'm not a trained professional. But I'm so intrigued by what the trained professionals are discovering in their ongoing research about neuroplasticity, the realization that essentially physical patterning takes place in our gray matter, and we can influence that. In an article published for UCal Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center, PhD psychologist Rick Hansen explains it this way. The brain is the organ that learns, so it is designed to be changed by your experiences. It still amazes me, but it's true. Whatever we repeatedly sense and feel and want and think is slowly but surely sculpting neural structure. As you read this, in the 5 cups of tofu-like tissue inside your head, nestled amidst a trillion support cells, 80 to 100 billion neurons are signaling each other in a network with about a half a quadrillion connections called synapses. All this incredibly fast, complex, and dynamic neural activity is continually changing your brain. Active synapses become more sensitive, new synapses start growing within minutes, busy regions get more blood, since they need more oxygen and glucose to do their work, and genes inside neurons turn on or off. Meanwhile, less active connections wither away in a process sometimes called neural Darwinism, the survival of the busiest. He goes on, all mental activity, sights and sounds, thoughts and feelings, conscious and unconscious processes, is based on underlying neural activity. Much mental and therefore neural activity flows through the brain like ripples on a river with no lasting effects on its channel. But intense, prolonged, or repeated mental neural activity, especially if it is conscious, will leave an enduring imprint in neural structure, like a surging current reshaping a riverbed. In the saying in neuroscience, neurons that fire together wire together. Mental states become neural traits. Day after day, your mind is building your brain. So, an old Cherokee chief was teaching his grandson about life. A fight is going on inside me, he said to the boy. It is a terrible fight, and it is between two wolves. One is evil. He is anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, self-doubt, and ego. The other is good. He is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. This same fight is going on inside you and inside every other person, too. The grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked his grandfather, well, which wolf will win? The old chief simply replied, the one you feed. So my crocuses and a few other early bulbs are up and blooming, even though I think April has been its usual cold, cruel self. Chaucer totally knew this. This is not our discovery on the seacoast. Your teenager probably did emerge from the covers sometime yesterday, eventually. Coffee beans and water go into the pot, and steaming deliciousness comes out. The male American goldfinches at the feeder are yellower than they were 2 weeks ago. The students from Parkland have sparked resolve in so many of our discouraged hearts. Some of us are doing good work with our therapists and life coaches to bring forth our best selves, a little at a time. Each of us sitting here got out of the house this morning to be in this place. Some of us are another day sober. The Red Sox are playing baseball again. really, really well.
We and our world are constantly emerging. Let's allow our tired, cynical, overburdened selves to be wowed by all that we can choose to look at that brings joy and hope. Now, I have never, ever, ever been accused of being a Pollyanna. I'm not even a natural optimist. I know for myself and friends and family, and maybe you do too, that there are places and situations that are broken, that haven't and maybe won't heal, that will never be okay. These things we carry, but they are not all of who we are. It's not that we're looking away from the whole of life, it's that we are not so focused on the bad and the ugly that we lose sight of the good, the beautiful, the wondrous, the new and surprising that's coming forth. Here at South Church, we are in this period of sabbatical where our settled ministers are away for 4 months of rest and reflection and renewal. So as a congregation, we've had an opportunity to think a little more deeply about what the mission of South Church means to us in our lives, and have heard people give testimonials and write newsflash articles sharing some of those experiences of this place. We have worshiped in different ways, with different leaders providing differing styles. More people have done more work to make these things happen, and more people have stepped up, literally here up on the chancel and behind the scenes in the sabbatical committee and the board of trustees and the committee on ministry and in the pastoral associates and the fellowship associates and the worship associates and all the staff. And we are all inevitably changed by this experience of continuing on these months without our settled ministers. Maybe we're a little more confident in our abilities, more willing to contribute, more appreciative of variety in worship, more wowed by the depth of spirit and talent in these pews. Maybe it's been rather unsettling. Maybe we feel a little more independent. Maybe we love our ministers all the more. And maybe it's a mashup of all of this. And you know, they're coming back in just about 6 weeks or so. They will be here on June 3rd, and they will take up their stoles. And just as we are not exactly the same congregation that we were on February 3rd, so Reverend Chris and Reverend Lauren will not be the same people in the same place that they were when they left. We will celebrate their return to us, the big emergence from their sabbatical. And hopefully, we will spend a lot of the summer listening. We to them, they to us, as we share together what things, large and small, have been born from this unusual period in the life of our church. And as we do that, as we share our experiences of what this sabbatical time has meant, let's be willing to be wowed, both by the substance of whatever these epiphanies might be, and by the loving kindness we demonstrate in our receptivity to each other's stories. So, I've heard it said time and time again that the only constant in our lives is change. The older I get, the more I experience the truth of this, regardless of my inclination to resist it. Our world is changing. Our culture is changing. The people around us, the situation of our everyday lives, our inmost selves, all constantly shifting. We don't need to fix everything. We don't need to force everything. How exhausting that would be, even if we did have all the answers. But we can notice when the change is good and mark that in our hearts as a sacred moment. We can celebrate the emergences from the fiery furnaces, the post-chemo haircuts, this unique time in the life of our beloved church, the gloriously yellow daffodil that wasn't there yesterday. We can be wowed. May it be so.